Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, researchers from Bucknell University are part of a team that discovered a binary planetary system 450 light years from Earth, and an astronaut from Pennsylvania who may be going to the moon. But up front, probably every worker in Pennsylvania has been impacted in some way by the coronavirus pandemic. Some lost their jobs altogether, had hours reduced, or took a cut in pay. But what about the benefits that most often are part of full-time employment? Retirement, investment, and healthcare consulting firm Conrad Siegel recently surveyed Central Pennsylvania employers to get their thinking on benefits and the pandemic. And with us today to discuss the results are Conrad Siegel partner and actuary Rob Gluss and retirement plan consultant Scott Gaiman. By way of disclosure, Conrad Siegel is a financial supporter of WITF. Gentlemen, let me start with you, Rob Gluss. What was the most noteworthy item to come out of the results of this survey?
Well, I don't think there was anything unusual with the survey. I think obviously one of the things that came out of the survey was the idea of flexible work schedules was going to be a big issue for employers. I think, you know, every employer we work with, right, everyone's looking at their business, at their benefit structures through a new lens now. You know, COVID has changed everything and it'll probably change everything going into the future. And so what you do see with the survey are, again, people focused on flexibility with work schedules. I think you're going to see that kind of work its way through the benefit plans as well. You know, people looking for other ways to deliver healthcare. Obviously, telehealth became a big issue for employers as we moved into 2020. You know, necessity being the mother of invention, a lot of people that even weren't comfortable maybe using telehealth type services were sort of forced to use it. So that, while it was something growing historically, I think you're going to see that, you know, really infused into health plans a little bit more. And I think that the take-up rate and the usage of that kind of a service will be more comfortable for people because they've sort of been forced to deal with that type of a service delivery system here in 2020.
You know, it's something that over the past decade or so, we've heard often that this is the way of the future, that this is the doctor visit of the future. And I don't know, it didn't seem to be widely accepted until the pandemic. You can't say everyone is on board with it now, but I think you see many more people, many more employees who are more comfortable with it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the case. And again, as we've all had to deal with, even just doing the regular course of any business, right? We all got more comfortable with Zoom. We got more comfortable with Microsoft Teams and that way of dealing with, you know, addressing issues and doing our day-to-day work. I think that also makes people more comfortable doing telehealth type services. Make no mistake, it's not going to be, something that is going to continue at the level that it's at. I think once things open back up, you know, once the vaccine is, we get back to a little bit more of normalcy, you're certainly going to see people want to go back to those face-to-face meetings. But I think the things that can be handled through the telehealth, people are sort of forced to realize, wow, I didn't have to go to the doctor. I didn't have to go to the urgent care. I didn't have to go to the ER to get something done. I actually can use this service. And now that I was forced to use it, wow, it actually is a little bit easier. So it makes it more likely that the simple things can get done in a more efficient, you know, more efficient platform.
If you have a question or a comment about employee benefits during the pandemic and what the future looks like, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We're going to talk about retirement benefits in just a moment. But Rob Gluss, you said that schedule flexibility is one of the things that was noteworthy coming out of this survey. Are you talking about people working at home because Again, this was, I think, something that has been a change in attitude for a lot of employers and maybe even employees, that some employers that just kind of didn't care for the idea of employees working from home now seem to take a look at it and say, well, you know what? This has worked out pretty well. Maybe it's something going ahead we can continue to do in the future. Is that what you meant by flexibility?
Yeah, I think so. Again, we all talk about benefits here, and Scott talks about retirement benefits, and I talk about healthcare benefits. But obviously, anybody's sort of paid time off and leave policies are part of the benefit structure also. And I think it's going to become a little bit more of an expected kind of perk that people are allowed to do this. And like you said, people found out that, hey, we can do this at home. I think every business now is looking at it and saying, how can I optimize this? You know, maybe I wasn't quite as productive. Maybe I wasn't quite as, able to do our work exactly the way we had done it before, but we were able to get by. But now, as we see that this is another option for people, again, I think what you're going to see in the future is how people can develop, you know, their own sort of workplace structures to maximize the value of doing that. So the participant, the actual employees, get some additional value out of that type of a structure. But at the same time, you also have to maximize the productivity of your business too. So again, I don't think we're there yet. I think this is all going to be an evolving thing that, every employer is going to be dealing with here over the next, couple of years coming out of the pandemic.
And according to the results of the survey, 57% of employers expect the trend to continue of working from home and anticipate more opportunities for staff to work remotely. Scott Gaiman, your retirement plan consultant with Conrad Siegel, what did the survey show about the retirement benefits for employees?
So the survey showed a number of things, and there's a couple different areas I want to cover. I think the biggest message for me was that 96% of employers did not anticipate any change in their employer contribution. They were very protective of their retirement benefits. So that was a big message, and that played out very strongly. I'm sorry, 94%. That played out very strongly with what I saw with my own employers who are my clients, in that they wanted to continue to protect retirement benefits and maintain that employer contribution. Now, there were a couple that discontinued or reduced employer contributions, but to me, that was a very solid message, in that they weren't quick to cut back on that. The other thing the survey showed is the CARES Act did permit employers to increase employees' access to their retirement funds. And there's a couple different perspectives on that that I saw in my own clients. We can to give our employees access to their funds through this crisis. Let's adopt these changes. Let's give them the liberalized loan provision. Let's give them the in-service withdrawal provision, and let's make this as smooth as we possibly can, because we know everybody's kind of in a crisis. Whereas a lot of other employers were like, okay, this is great, but we also understand, any money that's withdrawn now or taken out as a loan is going to impact long-term retirement savings. So maybe we want to take more of a wait and see approach and just see, okay, let's see what our employees are asking for. But as far as the actual survey results, what I saw in the survey, what I saw in my clients, and what I also saw in a large national survey done by Plan Sponsor Council of America, very similar. The in-service withdrawal provision was very popular. The liberalized loan provision was there. It was a little bit less so. And there were some companies that did include their employer contributions with their PPP loan forgiveness application. That's something we didn't get as much into after they expanded and liberalized everything, extended things to December 31st and from 8 to 24 weeks and such. But that was something where we saw a little bit of interest at first. So that's basically what the survey told us. What the survey did not really tell us is, where do we go from here? Because I think the bigger story in all of this is alludes a little bit back to what we were talking about with remote work and with Zoom and all these other new ways of approaching doing business and what impact that might have on the retirement plans. It was more of a forward-looking thing than looking back at what actually happened. And I think the reality is, you know, these days 401k plans and other retirement savings vehicles are very focused on education, just because you're in an environment where participants need to make investment choices. And so here you have employees who may have been furloughed and are coming back to work. You may have employees who reduced their contributions during the pandemic. You have a challenging environment in which you want to deliver education to help people get back on track. Maybe they took money out and are looking to build their retirement savings back. And we can't meet with them in person. We can't do group meetings, which we have found to be enormously effective in educating participants. So we're having to adapt to that as well in terms of employee education. And also in terms of the plan sponsors, employees who do the work with the plan, just in terms of online features, having the right controls and securities in place to work on your 401k plan for an HR person who's working online. So those are some of the forward-looking things that the survey couldn't cover. But that's what I'm seeing on the retirement plan side. And again, I think the big story there is, what are we going to do to educate participants as we move into this this new environment post-COVID?
Probably important anytime, but especially now during the pandemic. Rob Gloss, something that was healthcare related that came out of the survey, 54% of organizations who were surveyed anticipate an increase in mental health and substance abuse services in 2021. Now, that goes to the kind of stress, the kind of environment that many people are going through during this pandemic. But that's noteworthy. I mean, that's significant that more than half anticipate an increase in mental health and substance abuse services.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there with, the stresses and the isolation that's involved with, you know, people working remotely and being quarantined and, you know, feeling a little bit, you know, isolated, obviously, from the rest of their coworkers and from the rest of the world at times. You know, everybody has a different personal, you know, comfort level with what they're doing. As we've tracked data along this, you know, ever since this started back in April, obviously the telehealth services that we talked about before increased, not in a way that was unexpected, I think, because we sort of expected that to be the case because that was one of the few delivery systems available to people. Everyone was making that available. Insurance carriers were making it available at no cost to employees. So there was a lot of encouragement to do it. The most surprising thing that we saw out of that was they weren't the largest utilization of the telehealth in most of our, especially our largest clients, was in the mental health area. And that was a little bit surprising as we saw the data play itself out. You expected it to be just more regular office visit type things, but no, it was the mental health services. So I think it highlighted for employers the need to make sure that employees had access, availability of services in a platform that's comfortable with them. I think that's a future area for your telemedicine and telehealth services that has a lot of potential because, it eliminates the stigma sometimes of, you know, having to physically show up at an office building, you know, where somebody might not feel exactly comfortable doing that. Whereas doing things, you know, through telemedicine really makes it a little bit easier for people to have that conversation with their, you know, with their doctor.
Conrad Siegel, partner and actuary Rob Gloss, and retirement plan consultant Scott Gaiman. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Pleasure.
Thank you.
I just want to read a couple emails that we received that I don't think our guest can address this for sure, but, you know, these are, I look at this as kind of food for thought, maybe even a future program. Douglas says, now that we work from home, we are expected to work a full day even when there was a snow emergency like this week. So just pointing out one of the changes from working home. Holly tweeted, consider also that it's a bit wild to expect the same level of productivity through an international trauma. Maybe work from home without a pandemic would be even more productive. Just a couple things to think about that aren't necessarily related to the survey by Conrad Siegel, but something that employees and employers should be thinking about. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. A team of Bucknell University physics and astronomy professors made history as part of a research team that discovered a new binary planetary system 450 light years away from Earth. Dr. Caitlin Allers, a professor of physics and astronomy at Bucknell, was the principal investigator on the international research team who used NASA's Hubble Space Telescope to make the discovery. Dr. Allers, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. So, Dr. Allers, what exactly did you discover?
So what we discovered was a pair of planetary mass objects that are in what's called a binary. So these are two objects that are, you know, together. They're a pair. They're kind of a set of siblings, if you will. And what's really interesting about this particular pair is that they both are planetary mass, what we call brown dwarfs. And a brown dwarf is an object that is kind of like a star, but doesn't ever have enough mass to fuse hydrogen in its core. And so they're sort of the lowest mass outcomes of the star formation process. But then at the same time, they're very, very similar in masses and in temperatures to planets. So the objects that we found, which are, you know, very awesomely named OAF-98A and OAF-98B, they have these masses that are down into the planetary mass regime. So the primary, or I guess what you would call like the more massive or the brighter one, has a mass that's just 15 times the mass of Jupiter. And then that secondary, OAF-98B, has a mass that's just 8 times the mass of Jupiter. So what's particularly interesting about this pair is they have this incredibly low mass, the incredibly low masses, and they don't have a host star. So you have these things that have the masses of planets that have sort of, they've kind of formed on their own. They're out there on their own doing their own thing. And then the other thing that's particularly interesting in the context of this formation is the age of the system. So the OAF in that name, OAF-98, refers to Ophiuchus, which is the nearest star-forming region to us. It still is very far away, but it's the nearest one to us. And relatively speaking, this pair then is very young. So the age that we have estimated for this particular pair is 3 million years, which on the scale, astronomical scale, is incredibly, incredibly young. So this pair is still in the process of forming.
You know, I have to admit that when I read about this, and I think the term was used just form store stars or newly formed stars. You know, when you hear that, everyone thinks, oh, okay, this is something that maybe a few days, maybe a few months, maybe a few years. But you're talking about millions of years, right?
Yeah, that's right. But to put it in context, right, the age of our solar system is 4.5 billion years. So 3 million years is indeed very, very young relative to, you know, the age even of our sun and our solar system, and then relative, you know, to the 13 billion year age of the universe.
These two, OAF A and B, they're orbiting around one another, but at a distance of 200 times the Earth from the sun. Now, at that distance, how can you tell that they're orbiting around one another?
Yeah, so that actually was a lot of the follow-up work that we had to do to prove that OAF-98B is actually associated with OAF-98A. So we were not able on the time period that we have to detect any of the orbital motion. So the orbital period for this binary, the amount of time that it takes them to actually go around one another, it's 22,000 years. So we're not going to, in my lifetime anyways, we're unlikely to be able to detect the actual orbital motion. But what we can do that allows us to determine that these two objects are associated with one another is we're able to do what's called proper motion follow-up. And so what we do is we found this interesting object, OAF98b, and we said, this has the signatures in its atmosphere of having actually water vapor absorption in its atmosphere. So we're like, this is a really interesting candidate at that point. But just with a single snapshot, you don't know if what you're seeing is indeed OAF98b or if it is just some random star that happens to be along the line of sight that isn't actually physically associated. You know, something that isn't 400 and some light years away, something that is either closer or further. So the way that you confirm that is through what's called proper motion. So basically all of the stars in our night sky are moving ever so slightly across the sky, just, I mean, imperceptible to the human eye. But if you have a long enough time baseline, you're able to detect that motion relative to other stars. So what we did with OAF98 is we said, okay, we actually went back and we found that OAF98 was detected back in images long, long, long ago. I mean, I guess not 3 million years long, right? But back in 2006 actually was where the first images that we found where we could actually detect OAF98. And these weren't taken with HFT. These were HST. These were taken with the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope in Hawaii. And so these were images that you can just barely see OAF98b. But what they allowed us to do is say, okay, we had this image in 2006. Then we had our Hubble Space Telescope images, which were taken in 2013. And then when we were like, oh, this is actually a really interesting object, let's get some more follow-up observations. We then got additional images with the United Kingdom Infrared Telescope just this past summer. And what that allowed us to do was we could see that relative to one another, OAF98A and B didn't move. And so that said that OAF98A and B were indeed associated with one another and were moving across the sky together.
There has to be, okay, maybe there has to be, but I'll ask you to explain this. It would seem to be that there is some gravity between these two objects if they are orbiting around one another. At that distance, can there be gravity?
Yes, well, there can always be gravity. So those that have taken physics or astronomy probably are aware that gravity is what we call an inverse square law. So you're absolutely right that the further that you are apart from one another, the weaker the gravitational force. And one of the things that is really interesting about this object is that since the masses of OAF98A and OAF98B are so low individually, and they're separated by 200 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun, it winds up being that this particular system has one of the lowest gravitational binding energies of any system that we're aware of. And what that means is that the gravity that's actually holding this pair together as a pair is so weak that it actually is really unlikely that this pair is going to survive together to be, you know, the age of our solar system. So eventually, as the star-forming region of Ophiuchus kind of, you know, breaks up, and the stars start sort of the cloud material starts dispersing, this particular pair is very likely to be disrupted. So we're catching this kind of snippet, you know, of these two objects that have formed together and are currently in this binary, but we don't think that they're going to last in that binary for, you know, billions of years.
Do you have any idea how long they may last?
We don't. That will actually kind of be a, usually when these kind of star-forming regions disperse, it is a disruption process. And so, you know, I would say that it probably is not going to, that the binary is probably not going to make it to 100 million years old, but exactly how far in its future this breakup will happen is unknown.
What can we learn from studying OAF98?
So there's a couple different things, and actually they have to do with this sort of, with objects like this being this kind of in-between space between planets and between stars. So one is from the kind of the star aspect, These two objects are among the lowest mass outcomes of how objects like stars can form. And we have a lot of questions about how you form these incredibly low mass objects in general. So that allows us to sort of learn about the star formation process. In a lot of things in science, you learn a lot about a process by studying its extremes. You know, what happens when stars form at the most massive end, and what happens when they form at the lowest mass end? How are they continuing to gather material onto them? How do they form into this particular binary system? So one thing that we can learn as we find potentially more systems like this is how common they are and what that says about the star formation process. The other thing that objects like this are really great for is actually learning about the extrasolar planet process. These are, have similar masses and temperatures to extrasolar planets, but because they're by themselves and they don't have this huge bright host star, they're much easier to study. So even though, we needed Hubble Space Telescope to find this one, we didn't have the glare of this enormously bright parent star to contend with. So the analogy that we oftentimes make is, if you're trying to study a firefly, it's going to be a lot easier to study that firefly if it's by itself than if you're trying to study it when it is right next to a searchlight. And so by sort of studying these when they're by themselves, we're able to do things like look at how their atmospheres, what they're made of, how they evolve, what sorts of weather patterns they might have. So these are all things that we're able to do with these isolated brown dwarf or planetary mass objects.
I'm curious, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but without the light from that bright star, host star, what are you able to see as far as the surface of OF 9 or OF A and B, if anything?
So OF A and OF 98 A and B are they're gas giants essentially. So again, they're a little more massive than Jupiter, so they don't have surfaces per se. And one thing that when you go out in the night sky and you look at Jupiter, if anyone has ever looked through Jupiter through a telescope, which I'd highly recommend, it's beautiful. But what you're seeing when you look with visible light is you're seeing reflected sunlight. So a lot of what you're seeing from Jupiter is just that reflected sunlight. But what a lot of people don't know is that Jupiter also emits its own light. And that light, because Jupiter is very cold, comes out in the infrared wavelengths. And so if you were to go and look at Jupiter in the infrared wavelengths, you wouldn't be looking at reflected sunlight. You would be looking at light that is actually emitted from Jupiter itself. Now, in the case of OF 98 A and B, these are planets that have just formed. So relatively speaking, they're fairly hot. And the reason for that, it kind of goes back to gravity. So if I take, a book and I drop it on the table again and again and again and again and again and again and again, you would feel that the book and the table started to get a little bit warm. And that's an example of what we call gravitational potential energy being turned into thermal energy. Now, when you take all of the material that forms a planet and then gravity pulls that planet all together, you have that same thing. You're turning that gravitational potential energy of all of that material into thermal energy. So the way that OF 98 A and B are detected are through this heat of formation of the objects themselves.
You've mentioned Hubble several times. The discovery was made using the Hubble Space Telescope that is orbiting the Earth. Now, not everyone can just log on and use Hubble. How did you go about that?
So applying for time on the Hubble Space Telescope, it's kind of like submitting a grant proposal. So you submit a proposal that has all of the science that you want to do justified and laid out. And then that goes to what's called a time allocation committee, which is a committee of other astronomers that reads over all of these proposals and decides which ones have, in their mind, the best scientific merit, the best odds of success, all of that. And then if you wind up getting awarded the time, what you then do is you write kind of the scripts that are going to be sent up to Hubble for Hubble to be able to take your observations. So in when you're planning those observations, you have to include things like what wavelengths of light are you wanting to observe your object in? How long are you wanting to take for your exposure times? All of those things are kind of accounted for when you're trying to apply for the time.
But there's also some challenges in using Hubble. It orbits the Earth every 97 minutes. So things are moving around. That seems like it would be a bit of a challenge in when you're trying to find two specific objects in space, right?
So it is and it isn't. The main thing with the with Hubble orbiting the Earth every 97 minutes is that it means that if you're pointed at a particular region of the sky, that region of the sky isn't accessible to you continuously. There's going to be breaks where the Earth is blocking Hubble's view of your particular object. So that actually winds up being the bigger challenge is you have to, when you're awarded Hubble time, you're awarded a certain number of orbits. So your time is awarded in these chunks of essentially 97 minutes. And how much of that 97 minutes is usable depends on where where in the universe, actually, your particular object is that you're wanting Hubble to look at. So you have to sort of, when you're considering the wavelengths and the exposure times that you want, you're also trying to sort of get those to fit into a number of orbits that makes sense.
We have a question.
But Hubble itself is actually, it's able to point very accurately at these objects, and the images are amazingly clear and beautiful. Now, Hubble right now is starting to get a little bit older. It's getting on in years. And we have been finding of late that there's some trouble sometimes with some images it will go to take, and because some of the gyros are starting to go, it's having a little bit more trouble pointing as accurately and staying pointed as accurately as it used to.
Now, when you say images, do you have photographs of OAF 98 A and B?
You betcha. Yeah, okay. We have images that are taken. Essentially, they're digital camera images taken in infrared wavelengths of OAF 98 A and B. And sadly, for this particular region, because it's an image of these two, what we call point sources, they're not, you know, people see beautiful Hubble images like the Pillars of Creation. It's not like that. It just looks kind of like a picture of a couple of bright dots that are OAF 98 A and B.
We have a question from a listener who wants to know, what causes these gravity wells that create stars? How do you account for the randomness in terms of star density in space?
So I'm not quite sure I'm understanding the question there, but so stars are forming from these regions called star-forming regions, which is where a lot of gas and dust have kind of accumulated. And one of the things that has happened over the course of that sort of gas and dust accumulating is you wind up having areas where the gas and dust is just a little bit denser than other regions. And so those regions that have slightly higher densities are regions where the collapse process can then be initiated and that gravitational collapse eventually starts. And the way that it starts is actually it's kind of boring. It's just, well, I guess it's not boring. It's just, it's you wind up getting enough of this mass together that it's able to overcome any small amount of gas pressure that it has, and gravity takes over and does the rest.
I want to thank you very much for being with us today. One final question. What's next? Now that OAF 98 A and B have been discovered, what do you plan on doing next with the study of these two?
Well, so our next thing is actually, we were awarded time on the Gemini telescope in Hawaii to get spectroscopy of these objects. And what that will allow us to do is to, basically, you're looking again at particular wavelengths, but your wavelength gridding is very, very fine. So because of that, you're able to look for the signatures of particular atoms and molecules in the atmospheres of these objects. So we have time to do that, and we're excited to, really get a close look at what these atmospheres are composed of.
When will that be?
That is, we just submitted all of our observation information. That will be happening probably in May this year.
Oh, good. Only a few months away. Dr. Caitlin Hours is a professor of physics and astronomy at Bucknell University. Dr. Hours, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and congratulations on your discovery.
Oh, thank you very much, and wonderful talking to you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. NASA recently announced the Artemis team that will send people back to the moon for the first time since the end of the Apollo program in 1972. NASA will announce flight assignments for astronauts pulling from members of the Artemis team. Astronaut Woody Hoberg is one of the 18 astronauts to form the team that will pave the way for the next missions on and around the moon. Hoberg is a native of Pittsburgh, and he joins us right now. Dr. Hoberg, first of all, congratulations, but welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, not often you get an opportunity to speak with an astronaut. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. First of all, Dr. Hoberg, tell us about the Artemis program.
Well, with Artemis, NASA intends to send the first woman and also the next man back to the moon. This will be the first time since the Apollo missions, which ended in the early 70s, that we've visited the moon. So it's very exciting. You know, here at NASA, I'm watching the buzz of activity every day as we get ready for these missions, and it's a super exciting time.
What does that buzz of activity look like to prepare for these moon missions?
Well, it's everything from we actually have lots of hardware that's getting close to flying. So coming up later this year or early next year will be Artemis 1, the very first mission of the Artemis program. It'll be an uncrewed mission, but we'll be flying our SLS rocket with the Orion capsule on top for the first time, and we will send the vehicle around the moon, and it'll return to Earth. So uncrewed mission, but really exciting first flight of that system. We just had in January, the first green run of the SLS rocket. So we fired up all four engines. It actually, some viewers may have watched it know that it didn't go the full 8 minutes. We had some early shutdowns from some conservative software limits, so we're actually going to do that test again here later this month. So we'll be firing up that big SLS rocket out at Stennis Space Center again later in February. So there's just so much going on, and it's really great to see real hardware coming to life. That's kind of the really exciting part of doing all this.
You probably, when you say that, good to see it coming to life. It's no longer a dream. It actually makes you feel like this is something that's happening in the very near future. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Scott. I mean, we go out and visit the hardware and various NASA facilities all the time, and it exactly like you said. Sometimes, you know, I think back to all of these programs start on paper, right? And I think back to even earlier this year, it felt like, wow, are we really going to do this green run and fire up all four engines? And I actually went out and saw the hardware as it was coming together, and it's super exciting, but you also have this little part of you feeling like, I'm not sure it's actually going to happen. How could we really do this? And then it happens, and that's just the best. And I think it'll be the same with, you know, the first uncrewed mission, Artemis 1, later this year. And then, you know, with Artemis 2, we'll be putting a crew on board Orion, and they'll be flying out around the moon, not landing, but just orbiting around the moon and coming back to Earth. That'll be the first time we've left. That'll be the first time we've sent humans beyond low Earth orbit since Apollo. So that's going to be a huge moment for the country. And then with Artemis 3, the next mission, we're going to send a crew down to the surface and land. And that'll include the first woman to land on the moon. So it's just pretty awesome.
Now, that landing on the moon, there is something that is specific about that with Artemis 3, that the plans are to land on the south pole of the moon. Why is that noteworthy?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting aspect. So with Apollo, all of the missions went to the equatorial regions of the moon. So we every single Apollo landing site is near the equator. With Artemis, we do plan, as you said, to go to the equatorial regions. Those are really interesting areas of the moon. We actually didn't realize for all of Apollo that there is water ice on the moon. So we went to the moon several times, landed on the moon, and even after all of that, we did incredible geology. We brought back samples, did incredible science, and yet we didn't realize until much later that there's water ice on the moon. And much of it is at those polar regions. So it'll be very exciting to go investigate that. And it's also interesting, the lighting on the poles is very interesting. There are these permanently shadowed regions. So depending on the season and the orbits, there are areas, for example, down in craters that are permanently shadowed at these polar sites. But you might be down in a crater fully in shadow and then step out of the crater and you're fully in sunlight. So it's just really interesting dynamics there. It'll be very interesting thinking through the engineering as we, for example, might want to use solar energy, but also investigate things like this water ice that may be found in permanently shadowed regions. So super interesting part of the moon to go check out.
Well, good segue for my next question, and that is, what can we learn that we haven't already from going to the moon?
Well, there's so much. I mean, the science that Apollo gave us was incredible, but as I said, that was only the equatorial regions of the moon. So that would be a little like if you went to visit Earth for the first time and you only landed in maybe the Sahara Desert and the Midwest of the United States. You would see some of Earth, but you wouldn't have seen everything. So going to different areas of the moon, areas with potentially different geology, is extremely interesting. And so there's just a huge amount of science to be done to learn more about the moon, which of course tells us more about things like planet formation and all about how we fit into the solar system and the universe. So that's a super interesting part. Another part of it that I think the moon can teach us is actually the engineering that we need to go on to destinations like Mars. So as we think about going on to Mars, which we do intend to do, the moon gives us an incredible test bed to test out the technologies and operational techniques that we will be using ultimately to go to Mars. And I think that testing is an incredibly important part of an audacious goal like going to Mars.
To be clear, you're one of 18 chosen for the Artemis program. Assignments haven't been handed out yet. We have a question from a listener who wants to know, is there competition amongst the astronauts to be selected to go on the next manned mission?
Well, I think it's actually a really fun part of working here. You're surrounded by these incredible people, both in the astronaut office and also the broader team here at NASA that's making these missions happen. I have to say, it may sound surprising, but there's really not. One of the fun things about our job is every day is different, but in terms of mission assignments, it's really out of our hands, and that's just something you wait to get that lucky phone call where you've been told that you've been assigned to a mission. So, and in the meantime, there's just so much to do to get ready to go to the moon. So I'm focused every day on the operations we're doing now, right now, my current job, I'm actually working on International Space Station operations. Before that, I was working on the hardware to go back to the moon. So we're just super busy, and I don't think we really have time to, you know, worry about things like mission assignments. It just comes along when it comes along, and in the meantime, it's super fun, all the hard problems that we need to solve.
Well, Dr. Hoberg, you sound very humble about that, but there has to be a side of you that is dreaming. I mean, let me just go through your background. You hold a bachelor's degree in aeronautics and astronautics, a doctorate in electrical engineering and computer science. But before coming to NASA, you're an assistant professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and a seasonal member of the Yosemite Search and Rescue Team. But you're also a pilot. Question is, in those moments when maybe you can dream, do you dream about flying to the moon? Do you want to step foot on the moon?
Yeah, absolutely. there's really no
That's
other
an easy
way about
answer,
it.
Right?
Of course I do. Yeah, it's I mean, you go out and you look up at that full moon, and I feel like it's just a common human experience to feel like it's beckoning up there. Yeah, I've always enjoyed exploring, going to new places, experiencing new things, just kind of that sense of adventure. And what more adventurous thing could there be to do than get to go to the moon? So I both want to do it myself. I think that would be an incredible experience, but I also want us to do it as a country. I want us to be up there exploring. You know, as a young engineer, when I was in school, I remember this moment. I think I was searching for summer internships. I was an engineering student. I just wanted somewhere interesting to work for the summer on engineering problems. And I remember this moment where I sort of felt disappointed that I was not alive to work on Apollo, because that just felt like the ultimate exciting engineering challenge to send a human being to the moon. And I remember just being a little disappointed that I wasn't alive at the right time to work on this big audacious thing. But I never would have guessed that I would be sitting here getting to work on Artemis and doing it now. I think Artemis will be even more exciting than Apollo. We're going to solve bigger, more challenging problems, and it's just going to be a super exciting time. So I really can't imagine, you know, for young engineering students today, what a cool time to get to be involved in that.
You said that you're really looking forward to America going back to the moon. As someone who grew up, and I was young, during the Apollo program, it was a source of patriotism that the United States was the first to land a manned flight on the moon, and that Americans got to walk on the moon. I wonder whether Artemis will bring back that type of pride and that type of patriotism for the space program. What do you think?
Yeah, I really hope so. I mean, I was not alive for the Apollo landings. But even then, as I read about the history and learn about that accomplishment, I'm proud. I'm proud of my country for having done that. And if you think about it, there's nothing saying that we have to go explore the solar system or send humans into space or land on the moon. We don't have to do that. But how amazing and proud I am that we choose to go do those things. I think it's just really amazing. And it's one thing that I think everyone can kind of come together on, that this is something truly bold and extraordinary, and what a it's just sort of a unifying, ambitious goal.
We only have about a minute left. Have to talk about the reality that we live in today, and that is whether there's money, whether there is the will to do this. I know that NASA didn't get the amount of money that they had wanted in the newest budget. Do you think that this actually is going to happen, and that the federal government will get behind it?
I really do, Scott. So I think with Artemis, what we're seeing that's really exciting is truly bipartisan support. And that's just so incredibly important. There are programs in NASA's history that have not survived, for example, changes in administrations, and so on. But I don't think Artemis is one of those. It truly has bipartisan support. And I really think one of the key strategic things that's working with Artemis is, in the past, NASA has sometimes struggled when we've had to pit human exploration against things like science and robotic exploration. But with Artemis, we're bringing that all together. So the science is contributing to how we go. We're going to be able to bring back great science. We're sending, with the CLPS missions, we're sending precursor robotic missions to some of the sites that we're going to land on. So hey, it's kind of all one thing, and it's
Woody Herberg
for the program.
I'm out of time. I want to thank you very much, and congratulations. Good luck.